Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
Welcome back. It is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and we need to continue learning and praying and acting. Sorry about the pauses, folks, but I got kind of distracted. We're using a word that really requires maybe a little delicacy. So, again, be careful saying this at home, but usufruct is the term that Jefferson actually sent to James Madison. This was something that was done in a letter from Thomas Jefferson to James Madison, 16 September 1789. In other words, Jefferson was now sitting as the Secretary of the Treasury. And he got to remember, he just came back from Europe. He came back from this concept of enlightenment where, where they were actually throwing things on the table. And so when we read this, Jefferson kind of delicately, brings and broaches this subject. The intent is, if we start looking and expanding our mind outside of our paradigm, because bottom line, we don't know what we don't know. And the only way we can start thinking beyond our own paradigms is two ways. We have to start actually thinking that there are different ways that we can actually start putting everything on the table. And then secondly, we need to rely upon the Spirit to guide us in what is the right way to go. Because I'm telling you folks, our current property laws, our current property paradigm is being used against us, and it has been perverted, and we're at a point where we really need to look beyond the, what I'll call the pale. We need to actually start really figuring out, how can we now protect ourselves from these globalists? Because as far as I'm concerned, they're our greatest enemy. They live amongst us because of the affluence and the fact that they're literally living and walking among us, waging warfare. I can't believe how Bill Gates and many of these globalists have not been arrested in the United States, stripped of their citizenship, stripped of all their property, and basically sent out, out of the country, expelled, and sent out to their favorite communist country that they want to live in. Because if they want to live in a society that is fully controlled, a statist society, let's send them into, the brick-and-mortar communist countries of the day. They'll probably all go to China. And I say that because China is really leading in the new age of communism and statism. You don't see that level of statism and the sophistication in Russia or in Cuba. And especially, baked bread is about as sophisticated as it gets in North Korea. So as we dive into this, and welcome back, Tammy. Welcome back, Sean. As Sean and I were just wrapping up. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sean. Go ahead.
No, I was saying it's good to be here.
Yes, and actually.
And I thought I had a thought when you were speaking about Bill Gates and his ilk. It's amazing how the entertainment class, your Oprah Winfrey's and different people like that, tend to go towards a progressive to give the masses the idea that they're so charitable, when it's exactly the opposite.
Correct. Absolutely. And it is, those people who want more for themselves, in other words, they surround these are people that have access. In other words, you and I don't have access because, we can't get into those country clubs. But, those perverse other businesses or, players in that type of business and in that type of, lithosphere, then we actually can kind of see, wow, okay, there's entertainers, there's these moguls, there's all sorts of people that are there trying to get more crumbs from these billionaires. And you know what? I actually need to be fair here. Elon Musk is a man that has very evil and dark aspirations, even though he seems like he's done some really good things. Here's a guy that is actually going to control the information of everything. When you understand Starlink and the future of the internet and the world of the net, right? What do they call that? The world of things or the internet of things?
Internet of things.
There you go. I mean, Elon Musk is trying to lead that way. He's trying to do all sorts of things in being the person inheriting the control of all this stuff. You think he's doing this because he's such a noble, you know, kind person? I think he's on track of becoming the first trillionaire. This is what I am talking about, where the framers couldn't fathom independent monarchs. They have no country. They have no citizens. They have an amassed amount of such wealth and power and affluence that they can start wars. So, as we dive into this document, this is going to be kind of, you know, hard to follow. This may be a little bit, but it's a new view that very few people have ever even thought of. And I think it's important that we throw this on the table, that we make this available, because I think that this needs to be a part of the conversation as we start trying to figure out how we are going to create layers to protect ourselves. Now, first off, let me throw this out there. Homesteading. Tammy, do you know what homesteading is, and is homesteading available in Wyoming?
Are you just talking about a bunch of people who get together and homestead together?
No. Homesteading, what I mean by homestead. Homestead laws are where a person can actually go to a parcel of land that may be owned, may not be owned, but they actually start building a home there, and they start actually, you know, improving the land to where the land actually starts producing, and they start selling their goods that they produce on that land so that the state starts making revenue. Most states had, back in the old days, and some states still have today, homestead laws where you can go and take land away from somebody because it's just sitting there. And the land that you take, you improve. In other words, it's not like you take the full claim of the land. You take a small little quadrant to say, I'm going to put a little farm here. And that land that you make state claim to, your farm and property, your home, those things that you've built and improved upon over the homestead laws or under homestead laws, they actually give you a deed that becomes your property and land. Most of these laws exist on the books still, but they conflict with the new laws and the new, I'll just say, the age of propertylessness, or actually where deeds really don't give you the access or the ownership of your property, because the corporations, the banks, and there's this facade. This is all unconstitutional, but the fact is homestead laws were constitutional. The concept of this kind of was baked behind this idea that the earth belongs, as Jefferson said, in usufruct to the living. So let's go ahead and, you know,
just looking it up, it says no, we don't have that.
Okay. I know, I remember when I was younger in the state of Washington, homestead laws still existed. You could go out into the boonies and you could make a claim, put up a cabin, start growing food, you know, trapping, what have you, whatever you were doing, and that could actually become your land after a certain period of time. Yeah, I think you had to improve upon it for a certain amount of years and so forth. Same thing with, I know Oklahoma was opened up that way. A lot of the states were opened up that way, right? Where everybody just, it was a land rush. Yeah. You know, you just went out and you put your stakes in and you said, okay, this is my land. This is going to be where my farm is, my ranch, whatever. We are now at that point. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, we don't have that.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. So let's do it this way. Tammy, why don't we let you read, and good luck, because you're going to actually hit the word first. if you haven't tried to say it. But go ahead and read the first kind of two paragraphs of this. And what we'll do is we'll just kind of digest as Jefferson delicately breaks in this new paradigm to James Madison. Go ahead.
Okay. I sit down to write to you without knowing by what occasion I shall send my letter. I do it because a subject comes into my head which I would wish to develop a little more than is practicable in the hurry of the moment of making up general dispatches. The question whether one generation of men has a right to bind another seems never to have been started either on this or our side of the water. Yet it is a question of such consequences as not only to merit decision, but place also among the fundamental principles of every government. The course of reflection in which we are immersed here on the elementary principles of society has presented this question to my mind, and that no such obligation can be so transmitted, I think very capable of proof, I set out on this ground, which I suppose to be self-evident, that the earth belongs in usufruct to the living, that the dead have never powers, that the dead have neither powers nor rights over it. The portion occupied by an individual ceases to be his when himself ceases to be and reverts to the society. If the society has formed no rules for the appropriation of its lands in severalty, it will be taken by the first occupant. These will generally be the wife and children of the descendant. If they have formed rules of appropriation, those rules may give it to the wife and children, or to someone of them, or to the legatee of the deceased, so they may give it to his creditor. But the child, the legatee or creditor, takes it not by any natural right, but by a law of the society of which they are members and to which they are subject. Then no man can by natural right oblige the lands he occupied or persons who succeed him in that occupation to the payment of debts contracted by him. For if he could, he might during his own life eat up the usufruct of the lands for several generations to come, and then the lands would belong to the dead and not to the living, which would be the reverse of our principles.
Okay, so interesting. So he's kind of laying this out, and I think you're starting to see this. Now, this kind of even transposes, not just of the physical property, because they were living in a time where property were humans, where property was livestock, and unfortunately, under the Constitution, they actually made the compromise of acknowledging slavery. And so he kind of starts to this idea where people are bound, you know, in their service or as property, what have you, right, wrong, or indifferent. He starts really trying to focus on this concept of how the severality, which means a single person, as Madison pointed out, you know, property is that thing that we exercise dominion over that nobody else has an exclusive right over. In other words, your house, your car, those types of things. And here's the irony that I love always pointing out about communists. Communists don't believe that personal property is wrong. Yet I've yet to meet a communist, a card-carrying communist, that doesn't lock their car up and keep you from taking it. In other words, they're very protective with their own property, aren't they? This is human nature. In other words, the concepts of when you start realizing the paradoxes presented by ill or bad paradigms, communism is an ill, bad paradigm. The concept of you can't have property, but they actually do have property. They act like it's theirs and only theirs. They don't preach. They don't live the way they preach. All that being said, as we kind of look here at what Jefferson is kind of exposing Madison, any ideas on, you know, this concept as he's started to expose this? Sean? Tammy?
Yeah, I was just going to chime in that I thought that in the last one we read, Madison's essay, I lost track of it and didn't speak up, but I thought he was alluding to slavery. Is that what he was alluding to when he said that one class of men to serve the other?
Yeah, so that's not just slavery, but that's like a caste system as well. I mean, right. The world actually had these caste systems where you could be a slave, you could be a serf, or you could just be a part of society where you filled a very specific function. Like in India, the caste system, there's a certain, race of people that were, subjugated, they were inferior. And these were all, obviously, these are baked in paradigms that have survived centuries upon centuries upon centuries. So, okay, so yeah, we're talking, we're now talking about this legal thing called personal property, where he kind of dives into when a person dies, there's a process by a society of law where it actually goes on to the next person, to the next person. And he basically says, if we persist in this paradigm, eventually the dead own all the land, because the living people that are occupying it are just really the people that are receiving it from the dead. And if the dead hold it, like the creditors, like we talked about with BlackRock owning all the land or all the houses, when we start looking at the way we're living today, isn't that what Jefferson just said? That the dead is actually owning the land, where creditors and agents are basically controlling our access and ability to be able to have land and use land, right? That makes sense, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on it, Tammy, so far? Because you read, what do you think?
I mean, explained that way, that makes sense, but I guess I didn't really understand.
Okay. All right.
What you were saying, but now I do.
Yeah, so sometimes when we read, we, don't get the same benefit. This is why I like, sharing, going back and forth, because I think when everybody takes a turn in reading, or at least there's a sharing of the reading, the person that actually reads doesn't get as much out of it as the person reading along with him, because you're just trying to make sure you're pronouncing the words as you read these things for the first time. It's just like, there's that little struggle of the articulation. And so the person that's reading along actually, like I said, I think that person gets a little more out of it. But there's this other thing that actually happens. By saying something, you're actually committing an act. And in committing the act by reading, that edges a different form of memory. And believe it or not, it's hard for us to do the recall on that. But those, when you say things, when you've actually done something, it becomes a different kind of memory than just reading along and hearing. And so bottom line is, I think there's a benefit of doing both, actually saying it, reading along, and then, benefiting from both ways of reading, right? Okay, so now we're going to dive into the next paragraph where Jefferson continues. Folks, the whole point of this is to really start looking at what is our circumstances today? Who is actually owning our property? Who is buying and who's controlling our food? Who's controlling our access to build more homes? All of this stuff is literally playing out in front of us, where I think Jefferson was having a conversation that has been suppressed, unfortunately, because I don't know anybody that talks about this very specific idea. But I believe if we're going to go to the table in the near future, we better get to this table where we start having the adult decisions of taking back our government and how we need to move forward to survive in dealing with the real and present danger of all of these people taking claim or making claim, this is our land, this is our land, this is our land. No. So let's go on, Sean. Go ahead and pick up what is true of every member of society. Go ahead.
What is true of every member of the society individually is true of them all collectively, since the rights of the whole can be no more than the sum of the rights of the individuals. To keep our ideas clear when applying them to a multitude, let us suppose a whole generation of men to be born on the same day. to attain mature age on the same day and to die on the same day, leaving a succeeding generation in the moment of attaining their mature age altogether. Let their ripe age be supposed of 21 years, and their period of life 34 years more, and that being the average term given by the bills of mortality to persons who have already attained 21 years of age. Each successive generation would, in this way, come on and go off the stage at a fixed moment, as individuals do now. Then I say the earth belongs to each of these generations during its course, fully and in their own right. The second generation receives it clear of the debts and encumbrances of the first, the third of the second, and so on. For if the first could charge it with the debt, then the earth would belong to the dead and not the living generation. Then no generation can contract debts greater than may be paid during the course of its own existence. At 21 years of age, they may bind themselves and their lands for 34 years to come. At 22, for 33, at 23, for 32, and at 54, for 1 year only, because these are the terms of life which remain to them at those respective epochs. But a material difference must be noted between the succession of an individual and that of a whole generation. Individuals are parts only of a society, subject to the laws of the whole. These laws may appropriate the portion of land occupied by a decedent to his creditor rather than to any other, or to his child on condition he satisfies the creditor. But when a whole generation, that is, the whole society, dies, as in the case we have supposed, and another generation or society succeeds, this forms a whole, and there is no superior who can give their territory to a third society who may have lent money to their predecessors beyond their faculties of paying.
Right, and actually, that's based on knowing the point in time of the expiration of the individual. Many people today, and even back then, died with a debt perpetuating beyond their death. As a matter of fact, here's a little irony, folks. What happened to Jefferson's estate when he died? He had children, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So what do you know what happened? Most people, you know, don't know this. Anybody that's been a student of the framers and so forth might know this, but if you've studied Jefferson, you would know this. Jefferson, when he died, he amassed an amount of debt that his entire estate was foreclosed upon. Is that irony? Is that the epitome of
ironic, considering all that smack he's talking?
So Jefferson was a spendthrift, and when he was in France, he spent money on books and he spent money on plants coming to America. As a matter of fact, he was probably more responsible of introducing different agricultural plants into America, at that point in time, than anybody else. I mean, I believe he brought in different olive species and grapes and so forth, so that America would be able to start producing their own agriculture instead of being dependent on it coming from Europe. So, I mean, but he was doing this, and Adams was looking at him going, you know, you're doing this recklessly, because I don't think Jefferson cared whether he was the farmer that was growing the olives and the farmer growing the grapes. I think he was just really trying to do what was best for America. Buying all of these books, so we're going to go into a break in just a second, so I might as well start this, and then I'll finish this when we come back. So Jefferson bought so many books that he ended up selling almost all of them to the Library of Congress. The actual Library of Congress grew several fold because of Jefferson and Adams, because of their extensive libraries. I'll cut it off there, and when I come back, I'll kind of talk about how he valued the knowledge and intelligence from books. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so Jefferson, while he was in France, while he was traveling around, he actually went down to Italy, he went down to Greece, he went down to, you know, different areas of Europe, finding agricultural products, seeds, plants, what have you, and shipped them back. And he was actually shipping all this stuff back to a gentleman that we kind of call James Madison. And as a matter of fact, James Madison was the recipient of huge boxes of books. And so the books would go to him, James Madison, at Montpelier. And then James Madison would actually have to make a trip to put these things in a wagon to send them down or to carry them down to Monticello. And I'm not sure, does anybody know the distance between Montpelier and Monticello? Somebody can look that up. But back in those days, that wasn't just an afternoon ride. I mean, both, you know, Montpelier being in the northern part of Virginia and Monticello being west of Richland. Now, Richland being in the southern side of Virginia. So it was a good trek. And so that's one of the reasons why Madison didn't do it on a daily basis. But one of the things that Madison did do was he read most of those books. This is one of the reasons why Madison was probably the most literate man in America. I mean, when it understanding the philosophies, the histories, and all of these things, he'd read it, and he remembered it, and he was really profound about that, which is one of the reasons why he was so, you know, so intelligent and articulate in combating the creatures like Patrick Henry, Alexander Hamilton, and so forth. So anyway, so Madison was a pretty busy guy receiving all of this stuff from James or from Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was spending money he didn't have, and he was basically taking on debt to do this. He didn't care. What he wanted to do was he wanted to do what was best and what was right. He actually allowed his entire estate to be fully leveraged to where when he died, it would go into his creditors' hands. And what ended up happening was the people of Virginia came along and bought the Jefferson estate and made it a historical site. Jefferson also spent a lot of his time and money after his presidency on establishing the University of Virginia, right? So here was a guy that was, you would think that he was out, you know, in some respects, because I sometimes, you know, poke a little bit at him that here's a guy that was really building his brand because, you know, when he was the president, he was the first president to celebrate the Declaration of Independence, which kind of promoted his own writing, right? So in ways, it seemed like he was constantly doing things, but he never got the credit for his inventions and all. I mean, the historians know Jefferson's credits, but most of America doesn't know that, you know, the reason we had these types of fruits and vegetables being produced in America was because of him. So anyway, so Jefferson, you know, created this. He was talking in 1789, not knowing that he was going to end up dying completely in debt. So as you read through this and pointed out that when a person dies, you know, the land just gets transferred over to the next generation. That obviously didn't happen in his case. Back to the books, though, when the Library of Congress was burnt down when James Madison was president, Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter to John Adams because he knew John Adams needed money, and so did he. And he said, why don't we take our extensive libraries and sell that to the Library of Congress, or, you know, take a good portion of it so that we can sell these books to the Library of Congress so that they can repopulate their books. And they literally expanded the Library of Congress to have books that the Library of Congress did not have before. Because Jefferson and Adams, these guys, while they were in Europe, were buying originals or first copies or only copies of very specific types of books. So anyway, in reading this, I just wanted to share this, that, you know, here he's got this paradigm in 1789, but he, you know, the way he walked and lived his life, he actually did die, you know, in full debt, where the creditors came in and seized everything. So anyway, so Tammy,
I was going to ask.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Since he owed about $100,000, which is equivalent to about $3.25 million.
Today,
yeah.
Yeah, okay. So what was the question, Sean?
Just playing devil's advocate and keeping us honest. You said they were trying to sell their books to the Library of Congress to make some money. Uh-huh. Is that constitutional for the federal government to buy books for a library?
Yeah, so if the federal government needs to have resources and source material, right? I think government should have source material. They should have libraries. They should actually have, for themselves, source material so that, you know, they can further their education and understanding, especially on very complex things. It's within reason, because when we look at, let's look at the concept of Constitution Compliance Committees. Constitution Compliance Committees are basically going to be a resource of knowledge within people, but they're going to actually need to have source materials. Every county should actually, when you think about it, what should every county possess? Every county should possess all source documents that are necessary in understanding the Constitution, so that people can go and put their hands on it. Now, I know this may seem old school, but I'm just saying that there has to be some form, you know, and whether it be electronic or not, there has to be some local repository. More importantly, the reason we want local repositories is, are we literally going to be dependent on the internet? Are we going to be dependent at a certain point in time when all of a sudden it's not available? We no longer have access to the most invaluable information that we need at that point in time. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah. I believe that government should have these documents, that, you know, the state government, the county government, you know, I'm in favor of having libraries. Now, as a matter of fact, I think within the Constitution, in Article 1, Section 8, it talks about promoting the sciences or so forth. So let me kind of look that up real quick, because Article 1, Section 8, it says to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing these limited rights and so forth. But I think having the library there promotes it as well, by making people accessible to the knowledge. And so the public library is technically not a federal, it should not be a federal function, it should be a state function.
But right, or a community, locale.
Correct, absolutely. A municipality, what have you. But should the federal...
Well, I was just talking in terms of them selling these books aren't official documents or records of the government, selling them to the government for their own profit.
I understand.
And
that.
The government buying them from them for their own profit, aren't they? Isn't that favoritism? They're not buying other people's books. But
there were
Jefferson, Madison.
Okay,
were,
so
you know the original deep state, I guess.
No.
If you want to frame it that way.
So John Adams and Thomas Jefferson had the most extensive libraries in the United States. And the United States was actually building its own library. And as it was building its own library, that library got destroyed. And so in a basically a blink of an eye, without having to, you know, put dispatches and send people back to Europe to find the books, to buy these books, to bring them back, because these books didn't exist in America.
Yeah. What books could you be more specific?
You know what? You could probably look that up. But most all of these books were books that were written, you know, because America wasn't producing literary works. You know who the first literary author was of America? This won't surprise you. Thomas Jefferson. He wrote a book called The State of Virginia. And it was considered the first major literary success in the United States. And it was basically a snapshot written by Thomas Jefferson of the state of Virginia. And in that book, he talked about the government and all things about the state of Virginia. That's not what I would consider, you know, the Iliad or Homer or, you know, right. War and Peace. You know, but they actually lauded it as the first literary success. So America was not, you know, the beacon of where these ideas and things were starting to come from, but we were the next wave of it. In other words, when you really look at this, is one of the things. You know, forgive me for, you know, poking somebody probably at a personal level in the eye. And I've done this before because Mark Levin is a conservative that a lot of conservatives love, but they don't realize that this guy does everything he can to obfuscate and obviate the fact of Christianity in the creation of America and American enlightenment. Because it was truly the church, it was truly the Christian faith that built the Constitution, so forth and so on. And so in all of his books, he never once recognizes that role of Christianity in the makeup and the evolution of America. And how we took the Enlightenment from Europe and we built upon it in such a way that we took America and leaped above and past the rest of the world. We were the leading thoughts in almost everything, even though Germany and other countries were doing really very competitive work in engineering and so forth. Didn't mean that we weren't hitting the broadside of a planet or making it to the moon. We were. They weren't. So when we kind of look at America at that point in time, we were the laughingstock, and we were much like China was in the 1990s. I remember China, they had dirt rooms, and their sophistication in engineering and technology was just, it was behind the times. It was one of the reasons why Clinton committed treason. Because he was giving them technology that would allow them to quickly advance to our level in a matter of years. From the nuclear technology that came from, what was that place in New Mexico? There was that hard drive that went missing that ended up going to China, where they had the ability to do, you know, the enrichment of uranium and developing nuclear bombs and that technology, as well as the Loral technology of guidance missile systems and the navigation of satellites and those types of things. I mean, there was so much technology that he opened up to them all in acts of treason. And why was it acts of treason? Because every time he signed the ability for them to have this Loral technology, that a Chinese operative would give his campaign a bunch of money. This was all proven in the record. I actually have that record on the website. This guy should have hanged for treason in 1996 instead of, you know, talking about you know, did I have sex with that woman and Monica Lewinsky and all of that? This was all suppressed. They didn't want to hold him accountable. And Congress deliberately ignored all that stuff. But my point is this, is that what Thomas Jefferson was doing was he was actually creating a very fertile, out of all the men who contributed to enlightenment in America, I would say Thomas Jefferson was that guy. Because he was bringing in these literary works, and he was bringing in agriculture and these, you know, even designing and improving agricultural tools and equipment. I mean, he had patents on farming equipment. He was not just a lawyer, but so he had this huge impact that has been marginalized by our history books. James Madison, being the father of the Constitution, had the greatest impact on America and American government. So both of these men were rock stars. Both of them were huge in what they did, and they didn't do it for any recognition. You know, even though Thomas Jefferson has this beautiful monument, James Madison's memorial is not a beautiful monument at all. As a matter of fact, because of what he did, that's why I tell the story of his vetoing the Departments of Transportation, why Congress basically gave him a nameplate. That was his memorial. The father of the Constitution got a nameplate. So, get back into this document, the real point that I'm trying to bring up here is that Thomas Jefferson had obviously was looking at this concept in a different light than really how he was living his life at the time. But the reality is we are now living in a time where we have lost everything, not because it was legitimately taken from us. It's because government and our own government has actually not realized the threats and they failed to protect us. Remember, this all started yesterday with the two objects of government. What are the two primary objects of government? Why do we create government? There's two objects that we create government for. Sean, you know this.
To protect life and property.
To protect life and private property. That's correct. So I think who's up next are you up next to read this next paragraph? I think, Tammy, it's you, right?
I am.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead. Let's be careful of the, you'll notice like an 8 and some of these sub-references and all these numbers. So good luck.
Okay.
I know this is difficult, but hang with us, folks. Go ahead.
What is true of generation all arriving to self-government on the same day and dying all on the same day is true of those in a constant course of decay and renewal, with its only difference. Generation coming in and going out and out entire, as in the first case, would have a right in the first year of their self-dominion to contract a debt for 33 years. In the 10th, 33 years in the 10th. Wait, 33 years. So that is a comma. Okay. 33 years in the 10th for 24, in the 20th for 14, in the 30th for 4, whereas generations changing daily by daily deaths and births of one constant term, beginning at the date of their contract and ending when a majority of those of full age at that date shall be dead. The length of that term may be estimated from the tables of mortality, corrected by the circumstances of climate, occupation, etc., peculiar to the county, country of the contractors. Take, for instance, the table of M. de Buffon, wherein he states 23,994 deaths and the ages at which they happened. Suppose a society in which 23,994 persons are born every year and live to the ages stated in this table. The conditions of that society will be as follows. First, it will consist consistently of 617,703 persons of all ages, 21 years of those living at any one instant of time, one half will be dead in 24 years, 8 months, 3 days?
No, thirdly. Secondly, thirdly. Yeah, thirdly. Go ahead.
Okay, thirdly, 1,865 will arrive every year at the age of 21 years complete, 41 years, it will constantly have 348,417 persons of all ages above 21 years. Fifthly, and half of those of 21 years and upwards living at one instant of time will be dead in 18 years and 8 months, or say 19 years as the nearest integral number. Then 19 years is the term beyond which neither of the representatives of a nation nor even the whole nation itself assembled can validly extend a debt.
Okay, so obviously that's the paradigm back then, that validly extending debt basically is based on your life. But the reality is, or I should say, even back then as it is today, nobody knows that you could be shot or, you know, a health problem. Something could happen where all of a sudden you're not going to survive to the end of your debt obligation. Okay, so interesting. Let's keep going, Sean, with the next paragraph. Go ahead.
To render this conclusion palpable by example, suppose that Louis XIV and XV had contracted debts in the name of the French nation to the amount of 10,000 milliards of livres, and that the whole had been contracted in Genoa. The interest of this sum would be 500 milliards, which is said to be the whole rent roll or net proceeds of the territory of France. Must the present generation of men have retired from the territory in which nature produced them and ceded it to the Genoese creditors? No, they had the same rights over the soil on which they were produced as the preceding generations had. They derived these rights not from their predecessors, but from nature. They then and their soil are by nature clear of the debts of their predecessors.
Okay, so that's kind of interesting, right? Isn't it? Keep going. Go ahead.
Again, suppose Louis XIV and his contemporary generation had said to the moneylenders of Genoa, give us money that we may eat, drink, and be merry in our day, and on condition you would demand no interest to the end of 19 years. You shall then forever after receive an annual interest of 125/8%. The money is lent on these conditions, is divided among the living, eaten, drank, and squandered. Would the present generation be obliged to apply the produce of the earth and of their labor to replace their dissipations? Not at all.
Okay, so Tammy, at this point he's kind of laying out these differences of inheriting and these obligations and how the creditors basically can become the keepers of the land. Keep going, Tammy, read the next one.
I did. It's
the top of page 3. I suppose that the received opinion, go ahead.
Okay. I suppose that the received opinion that the public debts of one generation evolve on the next has been suggested by our seeing habitually in private life that he who succeeds to land is required to pay the debts of his ancestor or testator without considering that this requisition is municipal only, not moral, flowing from the will of the society which has found it convenient to appropriate land, become vacant by the death of their occupant on the condition of a payment of his debts, but that between society and society or generation and generation there is no municipal obligation, no umpire but the law of nature. We seem not to have perceived that by the law of nature, one generation is to another as one independent nation to another.
Okay, so we kind of read a bit along here. Any thoughts on what he's continuing to build this argument regarding, you know, how a life exists in controlling the land with the debts or what have you to a point to when they finally expire. Now, not all people live with debt. And as a matter of fact, most people today do, but not all. And some people control their debt to being only their mortgage. We do live in a society today where it's over 80%, almost 90% of society today, or America, is living hand to mouth. In other words, they're not, they don't have any type of savings that they could resort to that would be basically bail them out. In other words, if you lost your job and all of a sudden there was no ability to pay, feed you, or anything else, no welfare, nothing existed, you would be basically a pauper, a beggar. You would lose everything because it happens very quickly. When you can't pay your debts, all of a sudden, you know, your lights get turned off, your vehicles, your property, you get kicked out of the house, whatever, the rent. And now you're literally scrapping for cheese. So looking, Jefferson, again, as he's creating this scenario to try to present this concept of, you know, it's okay if society perpetuates itself where the living really do control the land. But what about the other alternative? So let's keep going. And Sean, go ahead. We've got 2 minutes. Let me see how much we have. Yeah, you can read this one paragraph in 2 minutes. Go ahead, get it. The interest of national debt of France. And you're muted, probably, right? No? Yep, there you go. Go ahead.
The interest of the national debt of France, being in fact but a 2,000th part of its rent roll, the payment of it is practicable enough, and so becomes a question merely of honor or of expediency. But with respect to future debts, would it not be wise and just for that nation to declare in the constitution they are forming that neither the legislature nor the nation itself can validly contract more debt than they may pay within their own age or within the term of 19 years, and that all future contracts will be deemed void as to what shall remain unpaid at the end of 19 years from their date? This would put the lenders and borrowers also on their guard by reducing to the faculty of borrowing within its natural limits. It would bridle the spirit of war to which too free a course has been procured by the inattention of moneylenders to this law of nature that succeeding generations are not responsible for the preceding.
There you go. Okay, so we'll stop right there. And what we'll do is when we come back tomorrow, Sean and I will bring in a different topic because I don't want to continue this discussion because I think it would be disingenuous to tease Tammy with the initial part of this and not go through the remaining two-thirds of this document we still need to go through and kind of look at Thomas Jefferson's analysis and conclusion. Again, he's just presenting something to James Madison, and we happen to be the benefactor of the fly on the parchment, the fly on the paper, because it's in writing, not in the wall, or not in the room, so we're not on the wall. But bottom line is, we're benefiting because we're actually seeing this intimate communication between these two on an idea that at this point in time has not really been digested, because we see today the vulnerability of the state of our life on how our property around us is literally being suppressed, taken from us, where we are being boxed in and we're basically being set up. This is why it is so critical that we really start looking at what we need to do and how we need to be prepared to move forward. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process,
process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.